I'm very pleased to introduce President Teresa Sullivan. President Sullivan took office last August, and the university community celebrated her formal inauguration 2 weeks ago. While these inaugurations are a tradition at American universities, and some aspects are standard, there is no single template. For the most part, the activities reflect the interests and values of the new president. And what was most impressive about President Sullivan's inauguration was that rather than being all about her, the events reflected what we most value about the university. The university's central missions are research, teaching, service, and healthcare. The inaugural events began with a research poster competition in which scholars from across grounds discussed and displayed the results of their research, both for a panel of judges and for the general public. I'm very pleased to report that the law school's own Professor Brandon Garrett won the prize in the law, business, policy, and education research category. The week also included a wonderful symposium that focused on using evidence to improve teaching and learning in higher education. The weekend began with a day of service and ended with an inaugural walk, reminding us that significant responsibility for our health lies in our own hands, or in this case, feet. This is just one of the many ways that President Sullivan has embraced the university's mission and culture as her own. She is an experienced higher education leader, having served in important administrative posts at the University of Texas and the University of Michigan. She is an accomplished scholar of demography and has also published jointly with law professors on consumer bankruptcy. And she brings to the job a deep understanding of the financial and political realities of American higher education. Finally, as I think most of you know, she is a member of the law school family through her husband, Doug Laycock, one of the nation's foremost scholars of the First Amendment's religion clauses and a member of the law school faculty. We're honored and privileged that President Sullivan was willing to take time from the end of the year crunch to speak to our graduates this morning. Please join me in welcoming the university's 8th president, Teresa Sullivan.
Well, thank you, Paul, and good morning, everyone. I'm really pleased to see so many of the law school alumni who have returned to grounds for your reunion weekend. 25% is a pretty impressive percentage. And I understand that we also have this morning some of the Law School Foundation employees, and I see some of my colleagues from the law school faculty, so I welcome you as well. If you ever wonder if I care a lot about the law school, you should know that in Cars Hill in the master bedroom, one of the last things I hear before I close my eyes at night is take care of the law school. But I don't actually need to be reminded, because the law school is one of the university's crown jewels. And your dedication as alumni and foundation leaders and faculty helps to keep that jewel shining brightly. I knew about this long before I came to Virginia, of course, and everything I've learned since I've been here has confirmed it. So I'm really grateful to all of you for what you do for the law school and for the University of Virginia. I want to say a word, too, about Larry Walker, who's here with Sharon. And you'll be celebrating his retirement in a bit, and I'll be on at my next speaking engagement by then. So I just want to say a couple of things about him. Doug remembers fondly a lunch he had with Larry when Doug was still a rookie faculty member at the University of Chicago. And I had the opportunity to use Larry's casebook in my own course on social science and law, which I taught at the University of Texas. So I appreciated the path-breaking work that he and his co-authors were able to do in something that's close to my own scholarly heart. Well, I'm going to talk about a few items of importance to the university right now. And I'm going to leave a little bit of time for a few questions and answers at the end in case there's something you wanted to know about that I don't cover. I'm going to talk about succession planning at the university and talk a little bit about some important legislation in the Commonwealth that affects the university, and then just a little bit about the capital campaign. So let me start off with succession planning. Of course, you know, the only thing worse than a retiring CEO is a new CEO, and so everybody is a little apprehensive about what kind of change there's going to be. I've made every effort to make the changes deliberate and transparent and not too scary this year, but one of the changes that I face and was not of my making is that both of my executive vice presidents are leaving at the end of the year. One of these is Leonard Sandridge, well known to all of you. Leonard's been the chief operating officer of the university. He has been at the university for 44 years, embodies a great deal of human capital and institutional memory, and has a vast portfolio. And so finding his successor is going to be very difficult. Leonard has agreed to stay on in a part-time capacity with me as a special advisor. For Leonard, part-time is at least 40 hours a week, and that's fine. So I will still have the advantage of that considerable institutional memory. I have deployed a search committee to look for Leonard's successor. That committee has been chaired by Carl Zeithamel, the dean of the McIntyre School of Commerce. They have given me a list of finalists whom I've interviewed, and we hope to be able to announce an appointment there soon. As part of preparing for this search, however, I looked carefully at Leonard's portfolio, and I did shift it a bit. One of the first changes I made was to have the director of athletics report directly to me. Craig Littlepage previously had reported to Leonard. I did this because the NCAA expects presidential control of the athletics program, and I felt that the surest way to convey that that was true here at UVA was to have the athletic director report to me. And I've been very happy with the meetings I've had with Craig and my interactions with him, his staff, and his coaches. Pat Lampkin, the Vice President for Student Affairs, also reported to Leonard. I believe that student affairs is something that the President needs to interact with on a very direct basis, and so July 1st I will be shifting her reporting line directly to me. There were also three vice presidents who reported directly to the provost, whose reporting line I've changed. One of those is James Hilton, who is the vice president and chief information officer. I'm doing this because information technology is a huge spend for all universities. And it's not just on the academic side that the provost oversees, it's also on the administrative side in our hospital. And so because of its significance to us, I would like to have that directly engaged with me. A second is Tom Scalak, our Vice President for Research. We currently do $300 million of externally funded research, most of it federal. That portfolio has been growing. It's very important to us. And again, it's not just something that affects the academic side of the institution. Importantly, it affects our hospital. It also affects the administrative side of the university, where we do the accounting and the compliance and all the other things you do with federal grants. I have named Marcus Martin, who was the interim vice president and chief officer for diversity and equity, to be the holder of that position and to report directly to me. Again, because I think diversity is everyone's business and not just the business of a particular portfolio. The other executive vice president is Tim Garson, whom some of you may have known as dean of the School of Medicine before he became provost. Tim is leaving the University of Virginia to assume a position as senior vice president at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. David Brenneman, who is the former dean of the Curry School, is leading the search for that position. I deliberately staggered those two searches because I think it's hard to invest enough effort into one big search without having a second big search diverting you. So we will not have a new provost in time for the fall. I have named Milton Adams, who is currently the vice provost for academic programs and a professor of engineering, to be the interim provost. And Tim will depart at the end of final exercises for his new position. I do believe that the timing was right to make these switches in reporting. I want to be able to give the potential candidates for chief operating officer and provost a clear understanding of our organizational structure, and also to conform this organizational structure a bit more to my own personal style. I want to say that I didn't do this without consulting widely, and so Paul can tell you that when I had my first retreat with the deans last August, I divided the deans up into three groups, and I gave each group a bag full of wooden blocks. And on each block was the name of the university office, and I said, build the organization chart. And so each group of deans built their own chart and then presented their chart to the others. And what we learned importantly was that there was no uniquely correct way to do this. They all had different charts. But there were some things that they all agreed on, and that's reflected in those reporting lines that I changed. By the way, watching the deans build with blocks was an exceptionally good experience for me. Everybody wanted the dean of architecture. All right, talk a little bit now about what's going on in the Commonwealth. When I arrived in the Commonwealth, I am, of course, new to Virginia. I've never lived here before. I'm new to the politics of Virginia. But it is not, as we said in Texas, my first rodeo. And I have worked with state legislatures before. So I spent much of the fall traveling around the Commonwealth and visiting with legislative leaders in their home offices. They tend to be more relaxed in their home office. They have more time to spend with you. I had a chance to have fairly deep discussions with them about higher education in general, the University of Virginia in particular, the other legislative issues they were facing, and it was good preparation for me when I did go to Richmond for the General Assembly. Last summer, Governor McDonald appointed a commission on higher education, and he charged this commission with a number of duties, but the most important was to find a way to give 100,000 additional Virginians undergraduate degrees within 15 years. We had close connections with that commission. It was chaired by Tom Farrell, who is the CEO of Dominion, but is also a former rector of the university. Another former rector, Haywood Fralin from Roanoke, was a member of the commission. And our current rector, Debbie Wynn, was also a member of the commission. So earlier this winter, they produced a set of recommendations that became the foundation for the governor's bill, which is called the Higher Education Opportunity Act of 2011, but also goes by the name Top Jobs Bill. So you hear both those terms used. And so these recommendations included boosting the number of graduates with degrees in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the so-called STEM disciplines, creating new options for expedited degree attainment, making better use of the physical facilities of the universities, and making better use of advanced technology in instruction. I just want to add parenthetically that these concerns are exclusively directed at undergraduate education. I have heard very little discussion by any member of the General Assembly or by the governor about professional education, graduate education. It's not that they are not of concern. Many legislators pointed out to me proudly that they were alumni of the law school, so they care a lot about that. But I think that they see the big need right now being with undergraduate education. So in October, I drafted a white paper for this commission because one of my philosophies of legislation is that you can't beat something with nothing. And I wanted us to be forward with ideas first on the table. Because I think, as Paul says, that gives you a first mover advantage. And these ideas were pretty well received. We are prepared to increase enrollment in the STEM degrees, particularly in engineering. Our engineering school is the smallest of the engineering schools with whom we compete for students. And we would benefit from growing the engineering school a bit and from growing our faculty. Fortunately, we are bringing a spectacular new engineering laboratory building online in September, and that gives us the ability to expand. The governor would very much like for us to offer a three-year bachelor's program. Our students would very much like not to take it. Many of our students could finish in 3 years. The average entering student at UVA brings 18 hours of college credit already, typically through AP credit. But they don't want to leave in 3 years. And so consequently, I have proposed to the faculty and to the commission that we begin to develop some 3+1 programs, which would allow a properly prepared and motivated student to finish the baccalaureate in 3 years and then take a 12-month master's degree program and leave in 4 years with both degrees. The parents see this as a very attractive value proposition. it will make better use of our facilities because those students will have to attend at least one summer in order to complete the master's program. It does increase the throughput with the undergraduate classes, so it will free up some additional capacity for the undergraduate students. And the students themselves get to walk the lawn twice. Once in the third year, once in the fourth year. So this summer, we will be training our academic advisors to look for students who might qualify for this program and offer it to them as an option, because if you want to do it, you won't be able to waste credits. You'll need to be pretty focused from the beginning. And I also want to emphasize that this isn't for everybody. This is going to be for a group of students who come in very well prepared, who know what they want to do, and who are motivated to work hard, including some summers, in order to achieve it. But the governor is happy with this as a way of meeting some of the objectives that he laid forth for this for the commission. We are going to seek to make better use of our facilities. I plan to expand our January term, and I'm planning to teach myself in the January term. And we also will seek to increase our summer enrollment. I think the low-hanging fruit, though, for creating additional degrees for Virginians is looking at the large number of Virginia adults who have completed 1 or 2 years of college but don't have a degree. And we have degree completion programs now in Northern Virginia and in Hampton Roads and here in Charlottesville, and we've opened a new one in Richmond. These centers offer an opportunity for adult learners who have families and jobs and want to go to school part-time to take a Virginia course with Virginia faculty, but to do it over a period of years. When they complete the degree, they come to Charlottesville and they walk the lawn too. But for many of them, that's the only time they will come to Charlottesville. We are also looking at improved use of technology in our curriculum, not because we want to increase enrollment, but because we think it'll create a better curricular experience for our students. We currently do offer an engineering degree completion program online in Virginia community colleges, taught by our engineering faculty to students who have an associate's degree in a technical field. That's a relatively small program called Produced in Virginia, but it's producing high-quality engineering graduates, and our engineering faculty are happy with it. But perhaps the most controversial thing that I have proposed to the legislature was that we would, over a period of time, expand our undergraduate student body by 1,400 students. I made it clear that we would do this only if the legislature would support the growth. And it would also be a relatively slow ramp up, because while we have the physical facilities for a slightly larger undergraduate student body, we need to hire more faculty and staff to be able to do it. I'm pleased to say that our projected increase for this fall would be 83 additional Virginians. We get about $8,300 per Virginia resident. The legislature calculated carefully 83 times 8,300, and they added $705,000 to our appropriation to fund the growth. This is an excellent precedent. The legislature has not done this in the past, and we're very happy to have had them do it. So it will be a relatively slow increase, but one of the reasons I needed to do it was that our plan will create 980 spaces for additional Virginians. Four bills that had been introduced into the General Assembly would have created 846 spaces, but they would have done it by creating a hard cap on the number of non-resident students we could admit. That's bad for us for a lot of reasons, including the fact that it's not a good experience for our students. One of the great things about being an undergraduate here on grounds is the great diversity of the student body. This year, for example, we have students from 130 countries on grounds. I don't think it's diversity if the students from Fairfax County get to meet students from Loudoun County. Fortunately, the legislators from Northern Virginia agreed with me and they withdrew their four bills. And so we proceeded with our plan, and they offered us some additional funding for it. So I'm very happy about that. Now, one thing I do want to say is that we will probably, in the interest of using our facilities better with these additional students, do some unpopular things. One of those will be classes on Friday. But I'll bet most of you work on Friday. So I actually think it's good preparation for going out in the world to work. A few things about the capital campaign then. We've raised about $2.4 billion towards our $3 billion goal, and I want to congratulate you on passing your goal. I was speaking to the alumni of another school yesterday. They're at 57% of their goal, so they've got a way to go. But this is really quite wonderful. When we're talking about this last part of the campaign, we have started using the theme Heart of the Grounds, and you will see some of us wearing this small emblem, which is an orange heart that has a V in it, which stands for the Heart of the Grounds. I mean the Heart of the Grounds both literally and figuratively. Figuratively, the Heart of the Grounds is our faculty and our students, and where we most need to focus our priorities going forward in this campaign is on faculty support and student support, because that is ultimately what makes this a great university. We have magnificent facilities, and I'm very pleased about those facilities. My predecessor, John Castine, built 134 buildings, which is truly remarkable. And it's a record that will never be equaled. And I have to say that each one of those facilities is magnificent. Some of you may have seen the South Lawn, which we dedicated in October, provides terrific teaching space for faculty in the college. Some of you may have been in Ruffin Hall, which is probably the finest studio art facility in the United States, and the magnificent athletics facilities, and on and on. So I don't see the need now as being a need to build a lot of new buildings. I see it as a need to put great programs and great people in those buildings. And we're going to need the help of our alumni in doing that. There's also a literal sense in which we speak of the Heart of the Grounds. And now I am speaking of a building, one of Jefferson's original buildings, the Rotunda. If you have passed the Rotunda lately, you have seen that the carved capitals of those Corinthian columns are shrouded in black. Some people think that that's a sign of mourning, and if it is, it's a sign of mourning for the building itself, because the columns are undergoing a process architects call sugarizing. That is, the marble is crumbling. And those of you who are tort lawyers will appreciate that those shrouds are up there to protect passersby. Because pieces of the carving have been falling off and falling to the pavement below. The most serious problem is that the roof on top of the dome leaks. And so we have water inside the envelope of the building. The university architect has brought me the photographs of the rotting wood inside. The leak has apparently been going on for some time. It is very urgent that we replace the roof. So when I went to the legislature this spring, I brought with me a baggie. And in the baggie were fragments that had fallen off the columns, and in the bottom of the baggie was what looked like fine white sand. That's where the marble had actually sugarized. And showed it in the committees, both in the House and the Senate. And they were horrified. But at the end of the day, the conference committee could not translate its horror into actual money. But the governor did, and so the governor amended the budget to include $2.69 million in state-funded bonds to restore the roof and the dome, and I agreed to match that money. So this summer, we will begin repairing the roof so that we can keep the water out of the envelope of the building, and that's a very, very important first start. But I want to emphasize it's only the first start, because the building itself is in serious need of repair. The columns will have to be replaced. The mechanicals in the building need replacement. And as you know, once we begin to do anything to this building, we must bring it to modern ADA standards. The building is not very accessible right now, as any of you who might be with someone with a mobility impairment would realize when you went there. So we're optimistic that we're going to be able to raise this money together in partnership with the state, but it will require that we ourselves also come to the table with some of the funding. One other thing I want to say that the governor did for us was to also release almost $62 million again in bond proceeds to renovate New Cabell Hall. This is very important to us because New Cabell Hall is the workhorse classroom building for all the undergraduates in the college. And it's had essentially nothing done to it since the end of World War II when it was built. And those of you who took classes there, it's very similar to what it was when you were there. So let me close by thanking you again for the generous support you give in the university, for the wonderful support you give Paul and the faculty here, in all the ways that you let people know that the University of Virginia School of Law is important to you, was critical for your career, is an outstanding place to nourish young lawyers, but is also very important to legal enterprise in the country as a whole. Your time, talents, and material gifts have made a real difference, and I want you to know that we recognize that difference and we appreciate it. If Paul will let me, I will take a few questions. Yes, sir. Ma'am. That's right. Right now, about 50 students do choose to finish the degree in 3 years. But we actually have some very attractive one-year programs. So those one-year programs are limited because, you know, there's a certain capacity that's put in effect by how many faculty we have. We currently have 2 one-year programs in the Commerce School, 1 in Environmental Science, and we have 1 in the English department. And the faculty are looking at whether they would like to expand those. So I'd say the current capacity of those is probably 125 students, no more than that. So we're probably not looking at a huge program here. But I do think some faculty will be interested in whether there's a one-year master's program that they might like to launch as well. Yes, sir?
2 questions. One, is the state got the performance funding with regard to the universities here, university colleges? And 2, is there talk about putting a tuition cap on college and universities?
Good questions. It's very likely that the Commission on Higher Education, which has not yet finished its work, will recommend what they call incentive funding, which isn't quite the same as performance funding, but actually works out to about the same thing. And so, yes, there is interest in that. In fact, when I first met Governor McDonald, he was kind enough to invite me to lunch in the governor's mansion my first week in the Commonwealth. And he said to me, you know, one of the things I want you to do is to raise the university's graduation rate by 10%. And I said, well, Governor, graduation rate is 93% right now. And he was gratified to hear that because his twin sons are first-year students. But one of the problems with performance funding in the state is that you would want to increase graduation rates, but that's really not a performance metric that the University of Virginia is going to be able to compete on because we're already there. So I will be looking out for performance measures that don't actually penalize us. But you know, there are many schools in this state that have very, very low graduation rates. I'm talking the low double digits. And so I can understand why the governor would want to increase graduation rates. So there's going to be this kind of tension that performance funding is almost necessarily going to be directed elsewhere than us.
That's a 6-year rate.
Yeah, that's right. I should also just add, because I'm very proud of this, we also have the highest graduation rate of African American students of any public university in the country. And there was actually a study done by Bill Bowen, an economist who used to be the president at Princeton, about why we were so successful. And what they found was that we were successful because we expected students to graduate. And so if a student is having difficulty, we view that as a problem to be solved, not evidence that that student doesn't belong here. So that was very reassuring to me, too, before I came here to learn that. Your other question is about tuition cap. I would say that there is tremendous pressure on our Board of Visitors with respect to tuition, political pressure. And they are appointed by the governor, and there's a great deal of jawboning goes on in the General Assembly about not raising tuition. But the General Assembly really can't have it both ways. They can't take the position that they'll continue to cut our appropriation, which is monotonically decreasing, and also say that we can't increase tuition. We are already a very efficient operation. U.S. News and World Report puts about 25% of their ranking of undergraduate programs on the amount of money you spend per student. Because to U.S. News and World Report, it doesn't matter if you spend it well, it just matters if you spend it. And so although we rank 24th overall in quality of undergraduate program, we rank 64th in spending per student. And those 40 rank point differences are a pretty good idea of how efficient we are. So we will continue to look for efficiencies, of course, but you know, at the margins, we're going to end up having to raise tuition if we can't get the money from the General Assembly. And realistically, all of you understand the political climate we face here. I don't think that we're going to see the Commonwealth come back to the table in a big way. Yes, sir.
Ma'am, when I went through the university as an undergrad a decade ago, there were a lot of horror stories about course availability and people finding courses they wanted to take or even needed to take for their desired majors being filled up by the time they could register. I'm curious what your thoughts on that are.
You know, it's a problem that I know of at almost every university. We had it at Michigan, we had it at Texas. One of the things that we have done is to develop a more sophisticated waiting list system, which lets students know when a seat has opened up so that they can, they're then told, do you wish to use your waiting list position to go into this class? Because another thing which happens is we've got not only the number of available seats, we've also got a certain amount of strategic behavior going on by our very smart undergraduates who will, in effect, hoard classes. So they'll sign up for 18 or 21 hours knowing they intend to take 15. And so some seats are taken up by phantom students. And if they wait until the very last minute to drop those courses, then those seats are never available to other students. So we have to develop a program that's sophisticated enough to defeat the strategizing and make the seats available to the students who really need them. The other thing is that these sometimes you find that these courses that are closed, what's really closed are the sections that are offered between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. So sometimes we have to persuade students that, you know, actually there are hours that occur before 10 a.m. that you could take a class in. But we are very conscious of this, and both the advisors and the deans watch closely for class availability. And when necessary, we'll open new sections if we have to. Yes, sir. Yes. So our plan is to enlarge the undergraduate student body by about 1,400 students, but over a period of between 4 to 6 years. So it will be a fairly long range increase. And as I said, this fall we're talking about 83 new seats for Virginians. So it's a pretty slow ramp up. Yes, sir.
Are all those additional spots going to Virginians eventually?
No. One of the advantages of our plan was that it let us keep our 70-30 ratio. So there will also be non-Virginians admitted. But of course, the General Assembly doesn't want to hear about them. They just want to hear about the Virginians. Yes, sir.
Could you address a little bit of maintaining faculty-student ratio in light of this plan to increase enrollment?
Right. So we are committed to at least keep the current student faculty ratio or improve it if possible. And so in allocating the new faculty positions that we'll be hiring for, we are looking for the places that need the greatest help right now. The largest single major in the college today is biology. We're actually in a position where I could not offer one more biology laboratory. I just don't have any personnel to do it. So biology is a very likely place that we'll make some early hires. So we're looking carefully, particularly at courses first year students take, for where we'll be making these new hires. There is a committee made up of associate deans from the undergraduate schools that's looking at this. Yes, sir?
You're going to have the athletic department report directly to UNM.
Yes.
Will you be able to share some of the secrets with the University of Texas University?
Yes, that is one of the advantages. Yes, sir.
What efforts are being made to more integrate the North Grounds with the rest of the university and really have the students that come to the graduate schools here feel more a part of the university and connect with the people?
That's a really good question, and it is something that is of concern to us. We do have a pretty good transportation system. And so we have provided, you know, easy access back and forth between the two. But I don't think that's sufficient. I think you need to give law and Darden students reasons to want to be on the central grounds. And I think we have to give our undergraduate students reasons to want to come up here and see North Grounds. The undergraduates who come up here are coming up here mostly for recreational and athletic facilities, which are quite nice up here. So there are undergraduates who do make it up here. But we're looking for more programs, particularly interdisciplinary and co-curricular programs that will be attractive to law and Darden students. Of course, law and Darden students are already very busy. And so, you know, for a lot of them, you know, doing one more thing is not really what they're centrally focused on right now. The fact that the ranges are occupied by graduate and professional students does bring some number of students naturally to Central Grounds. And of course, those are some of your strongest leaders in the law school student body. And I think that's another thing that helps to bring their classmates down, because they understand the kind of events their classmates would be interested in. Actually, you know, one of the secrets of Virginia's strength in terms of student leadership has been, if you look at most American universities, what happens to fourth-year students, particularly your student leadership group, is that they have scattered to the four winds. And so they're living in all kinds of housing all around the university. And if you wanted to ever get them together, you have to plan for 3 weeks to do it. If you want to do it here, you can stand in the middle of the lawn and blow a whistle. And they're all there. Makes it much easier for students to get things organized, which they do very well because leadership is so concentrated. I want to thank all of you for being such a wonderful audience, and it was great to be with you here this morning.